We'll just get the slides up in a minute, but let me begin by saying namaste, my pranams to all of you. I'm very happy to be in your midst, and it's a very lovely feeling to be in this hall, which has been sanctified by the oblations which took place in the morning and the vibrations of the lovely devotional bhajans. And in the next few minutes, I would be telling you a bit about our research related to yoga and wellness in all senses, physical, mental, emotional, and very appropriate to today, the wonderful Sunday morning, spiritual wellness. Okay, so these are the technical glitches. We'll just wait for a few seconds. It's a very informal thing, so if you feel to come closer and ask questions later on, feel free. Till the slides get up, I will go on with what I had to say. That is, really, this is going to be a research-based presentation where all the facts that I present have been published in scientific journals which are internationally acceptable. So if we talk about research in yoga, the question which may arise in our minds is which is the best laboratory that there ever was to study this great Indian tradition, this great Indian science? Which were the best scientists? And the answer which comes to mind, and the answer that we get, okay, so that's a little glimpse, that's a little glimpse of one of the buildings in Haridwar. And this brings me on the left side to the answer I wanted to provide you. Who were the best scientists, the best researchers in yoga? They were the sages and rishis of India. And what was their laboratory? Their laboratory was not the conventional laboratory which you see on the right. Their laboratory was their own body, their own minds, their own experiences. And luckily for us, and very lucky that's happened for our culture, and unfortunately it's not happened for many other great ancient cultures, these traditions have luckily in Indian culture been passed down either through word of mouth or through etchings on palm leaves and so on, whereas many other great traditions are lost and there's no way of getting them back again. But in today's world, it's not just enough to say I experienced this, you actually have to prove it. Because there are skeptics, and it's good to think really and use your intellect. And so we have people meditating hooked up to wires and in scanners. We look at their cells. But we also do older techniques, observation and introspection, even today. If one combines the two, observation and introspection, let us first go back, revert to the ancient science. And we realize that the ancient rishis or sages of India actually looked at the body in a very different way from the way that modern or conventional medicine teaches us to look at it. Like in conventional medicine, we look at the physical body predominantly. We talk about the muscles, the nerves, the tendons, we dissect it, and it's something tangible that you can touch and feel. Whereas the ancient rishis, through their experiences, sensed that there was more than that. And actually, this theory is now fairly acceptable, and I was able to publish it in a medical journal, so that's why I put this reference. You might have heard this concept, which is from one of the Upanishads, that the body really has not just one level, or the physical level, which we are all aware of, but four other levels, and a fifth level in which it is ideal to live. What are the four levels? We'll see that in the next slide, where the Sanskrit terms are on the left and the English terminology is on the right. The Anamaya Kosha, quite understandably, corresponding to the physical sheath, like the substance or the substrate, the food from which the body is made. But the second level is the pranic level. The prana is the life energy. In Chinese medicine, of course, it's called qi. It is the difference between a live body and a body which is no longer alive. What is prana? Can we quantify it? As yet, no. but it is nonetheless there. The third and fourth level actually belong in our brain. The third level is our instinct or our emotions. So we feel to do something and we do it instinctively. This is true for all species, but man has a fourth level, that is to choose. And it is indeed said that yoga is the ability to choose to respond, not to respond, or to respond differently to any stimulus. So discrimination is the fourth level. And if these four levels function in perfect harmony, then our body is in medically a condition which we call homeostasis, or very simply a state of balance. We are not at war. We are not trying to be show that we are happy when we are unhappy. Or we are not trying to put up with a grumpy boss by placating him or being very pleasant. And inside we are very sad and troubled. This is not good for the body. It's recognized as what is called the type C personality or the cancer-prone personality, where a person keeps one face in public and a different face inside. So how you are in your inner room, in yourself, to yourself, should be what you are in public. That's the message. And if we can do that, we can be in our real state, the state of ananda or pure bliss. Let's move a little further and see how we can do that. We'll look at how it can go wrong first. If there is an imbalance between thinking and feeling, so we are thinking something not so good, but we are in a social situation and we have to keep a happy face. So now this creates an imbalance. And in yoga, it is said that this shows up as an imbalance in the subtle energy or the prana, and the very first manifestation of that is in irregular breathing. Just as in Ayurveda, an early sign of any imbalance is the pulse diagnosis, it's almost come to be synonymous with that in yoga, that the early sign of a disorder is erratic breathing. In fact, I've just come from a breathwork summit in New York, where the whole thing was only about the breath. How important the breath and the regularity of the breath is to health. So, what happens if the breath is irregular? It can manifest as disease. We'll look at that in a minute. But first we'll look at why the breath is important. The breath, if you think about it, is one of the few functions which we can control up to an extent. Like if I ask you all now to try holding your breath up to a point till the carbon dioxide builds up in your blood, you can hold your breath. When it reaches breaking point, you'll take a deep breath. But you can't control, at least within normal knowledge of physiology, your blood pressure. I can't control my blood pressure. I can't control my heart rate. I can't control the digestion of the food which is happening in my body. All this is going on without my will. So whether I'm awake or whether I'm asleep, these functions happen. But when I'm awake, I can control my breathing up to a point, right? So it is one way, one link, as it were, between the body and the brain. And this is what the ancient sages recognized. And that is why pranayama, which is the fourth stage in the Ashtanga of Patanjali, after yamas, niyamas, asanas, the fourth is pranayama. Why is it given so much importance? Because as it is mentioned in the Hatha Yoga text, by restraining the movement of prana, one can restrain the movement of the mind. And so a yogi, in order to attain steadiness of the mental state, should restrain and regulate the movement of vayu or air. And this is why there are so many different types of pranayamas. Some alter the rate, some alter the depth. So there is rate could be Kapalabhati, which could be a pranayama depending on the rate, or a kriya. There could be the depth, which is Bhastrika or bellows breathing. Some of you may be knowing these terms. Is that, yeah? Okay. And then there is the victory breathing, like Ujjayi breathing, and so on. But I'm just going to talk on one example. we can manipulate our breathing by breathing through either the left nostril or the right nostril or through alternate nostrils. One of the facts which present-day neurology recognizes is that throughout the day, with a gap of about 1 to 4.5 hours, irrespective of yoga, all of us shift between the left and right nostril all the time. Why is this so interesting? We'll see in a minute. And again, we go back to ancient texts. This is the Swara Yoga text, very ancient. It was said that when the air was flowing through the left nostril or Swara, one should do peaceful work. Peaceful would mean obtaining nourishment, which means it's entirely against our ancient wisdom if we try to eat on the run or eat at a computer or eat while driving. That's not it. Eating is an act of which has to be done in a very peaceful environment, very peaceful mental state, collecting grain and so on. And you must remember it was written thousands of years ago in India. So the energizing activities which were described in relation to the flow of air through the right swara were quite different. Like studying, it was understood that studying requires energy, because indeed the brain takes up 20% of all our calories. So if you really want to burn calories, use your brain more. Journeying, hunting, controlling an elephant, well, we do that in India even today. And all these are activities which require energy. And it is recommended that one breathes through the right nostril. Now, we were curious, can we find the same thing in the laboratory? So we studied it. And I'm going to present to you in the next few minutes a series of studies done through a number of years on various groups of different numbers, because it will be too long to describe each study individually. The references are provided on each slide. And if any of you would like any of the papers, do write in to me. Shekharji has the email contact. So let's look particularly at these three pranayamas. The right uninostril breathing, called Surya Anulom Vilom, which is actually Surya, of course, is the sun, which is why we have the picture of the sun there. Chandra Anuloma Viloma, which is related to cooling and so is considered to be related to the moon. And alternate nostril breathing, which is supposed to bring about balance. And that's how I've put the sign of a balance over there. Let's see what we found in the lab by experiments like this. Right uninostril breathing increases the oxygen consumption. What does that mean for all of us? It means it helps us burn more calories. But a word of caution here, that means it really helps a person lose weight. In the very early stages of my career, I discovered this just after my PhD. And I remember I was presenting it to a group and there was a Russian woman sitting there. She was very eager to lose weight. So she plugged her left nostril with cotton wool. So she wasn't doing it the pranayama way. She plugged her left nostril with cotton wool and walked around breathing only through the right nostril for 3 days, hoping to lose weight. I don't know whether she lost weight or not, but her body got in a state of imbalance. She had headaches, she had diarrhea. So all these practices are very powerful and should be done with a trained yoga teacher. But really, right nostril breathing is effective in weight loss. We'll see some of the applications. It does increase the blood pressure a little, so it should be preferably used in younger people. It improves attention. So if you have, particularly we've tried it, and I co-supervised a thesis in the University of Sydney in Australia on yoga for ADHD, that is children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and we particularly used right uninostril breathing. Very effective. It also improves the brain functions on the right side. You know, the right part of the brain is concerned with intuition, like the bhakti part, which we just had, aesthetic appreciation, anything that you enjoy. When you're focusing more on science and mathematics, like I do say, and many of you will be doing, then you're using your left brain. So if you want to bring about balance, it's nice to do a little right nostril breathing. So because of the slight increase in blood pressure, we recommend it for the young obese, and these are a growing population in India, slow learners, but again children, and young people who are depressed. Very effective. Alternate nostril breathing. In fact, I just had good news that this paper has been accepted for publication. Has one effect, many effects, but I want you to go away with at least one take-home message. 18 minutes of anulom vilom pranayama without breath holding is now, I would consider, proven, because we've got really strong publications in this area and I can send them to you. It can reduce the blood pressure in normal people as well as in people who have hypertension. Okay? So 18 minutes of anulom vilom or alternate nostril breathing brings about a balance between the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight, and the parasympathetic system, which is the rest and digest. So it brings the two in harmony. And with that, brings about a balance in the blood pressure. Several publications now in this area. Very strong. I'm now wanting to actually test it against a conventional allopathic antihypertensive medication. And I feel it would be at least as effective. So I would like you to have this as a take-home message. It also brings about the balance between the left half of the brain, science, maths, too much of it nowadays in our curriculum, and art, appreciation, music. We need more of that. Let's move on and see how yoga can be used in the promotion of positive health, prevention of disease, and management of certain diseases. I think I'm okay with that. Okay, so promotion of positive health. When we want to promote positive health, one of the areas we are most keen on is start young. So start with children. But also it's important for adults. So I'll be covering that. And senior population. So these are the three areas we look at. And some of the studies very briefly. We did a randomized controlled trial in Haridwar. So you can see, of course, all of you from here probably would know where Haridwar is located. And this study got published in the journal which is mentioned on the left. What was the study? We had 90 children and we randomized them as two groups. One group had 45 minutes of yoga 5 times a day for 3 months. 5 times a week for 3 months. Another group had 45 minutes of physical exercise 5 times a week for 3 months. So one group yoga, one group physical exercise. What did we test? We tested their physical fitness using a battery called the Eurofit Fitness Battery, which tests about 17 different aspects of physical fitness. We tested some aspects of cognition, their behavior, like punctuality, the way they behaved with other children, the way they were behaving with their parents, teachers, and so on, as well as their academic performance, and finally, their emotional sense of integration and self-esteem. It was interesting to note, first of all, let me show you a picture of the children. It's rather sweet. So we had them doing yoga. We had the other group doing physical exercise, and the three differences between yoga and physical exercise. Yoga is done with awareness. So you can run on a treadmill and watch the TV or read a magazine or read a book, but you can't do yoga that way. Right? Then yoga is in deep relaxation and yoga is with respiration. So you're always aware of your breathing. So even if you're doing a particular posture or whether you're sitting in meditation or whether you're enjoying the havan or the bhajans, you're continuing to breathe very rhythmically, very normally. So these are the three differences. What about the results? On all the counts that we studied, physical fitness, cognitive abilities, behavior, academic performance, the two groups were comparable. There was just one difference, and that is in the emotional well-being. What aspect? That is, the aspect was the self-esteem. It was very interesting when we studied the children in India, and we studied not just this school, but other schools in India, we found that one of the, and it's a cause for all of us as people from that subcontinent, that our children from there, the cause for low self-esteem is if they don't do well in exams. So around 63% said a child rated themselves, "I feel bad about myself if I don't do well in my exam," not based on their appearance, as it is in many Western countries, or not based on the type of clothes they wear or their socioeconomic status, but their academic performance. And that's why each year after the so-called board exams, that is the 10th and 12th standard, which are critical exams, as many of you would know in India, we have a number of suicides, and we now have a 24-hour helpline, because young people, it's not parental pressure anymore. They have this pressure within them. And yoga improved their self-esteem. Both general, as well as the way they felt their parents perceived them. And I felt this was such an important point. Other things were comparable, physical exercise and yoga. But the emotional aspect is where yoga really made the impact. We look at now an adult population. Okay, if this is just one more study to show you some of our health benefits, where we've looked at children who have a degenerative disorder. If any of you want more, I will tell you about it. Another very important thing which is coming up in India, and of course it is already there in this country, the computer professional, software professionals. It's done a lot for the economy. People are happy about that. But it's also got a lot of mental stress, musculoskeletal problems, computer vision syndrome, not myopia, but dry eye, because you just carry on looking at the monitor, and techno stress, like the computer didn't work, we didn't get excited, but those people are clocking in their minutes, so they get very stressed. In fact, there was a terrible, I mentioned this in New York, and people were horrified. There was a terrible incident of road rage in Bangalore some months ago, where a software professional was going on a good road. So it's a good road now. And another car came a little in ahead of him, which might have meant he'd reach his software company a few minutes later. And this person was so worked up already, charged and tense because of the work that he had to do, that he got out, and this is so unbelievable, he took the charger of his laptop and strangled the other man to death. I don't know if this has reached you here, but it was a very horrifying incident in Bangalore, particularly in the National Institute where I did my PhD, because that's concerned with mental health. So there's a lot of emphasis on looking at this population. 23% of software professionals take anti-anxiety medication, which you can get over the counter in India. You cannot get Tranax, I think would be the equivalent. You can't get it without a prescription in America, but you can get it in India in many of the small shops. So we did do a randomized control trial on 200 people, and we taught them yoga for 45 minutes a day, different things, some for the back and arms, for the posture, for the breathing, for the mental stress, and for the eye. There are a lot of exercises you can do to relax your eyes. So at the end of that, we found benefits in almost all of them and published it. So there was reduced stress, reduced visual and musculoskeletal discomfort, increased flexibility, very important for all of you who have to sit for a long time in a chair in an office. There's a lot yoga can do. And quite at the other end of the spectrum is another occupational hazard, where we were approached by an army base in North India, where these people are actually asked to stay. They are asked to be fit, and at any time they can be sent to a zone of combat. So they have to be ready and waiting, and it's often very boring for them because they play games and they don't know how to spend their time, and suddenly they are sent to an area of active combat, either the Indochina border or Assam or wherever there is some conflict. So these people are under a lot of stress. We were asked to teach them yoga with one condition: it should reduce their stress but keep their reflexes, alertness intact. And we were able to do that. So can we teach yoga in a way which will help them to remain alert but relaxed? And I'm not going to trouble you with graphs on a Sunday morning, except to say that this is an old slide, so it's saying in press, but it's well published. It is possible, right? Now we look at yoga and Ayurveda for healthy older persons. So this was a home for the aged in Bangalore. We screened 120 people. We got 69 who were totally free from disease. And you have the session in yoga session in progress. These are the components of the Ayurveda Rasayana. Many of them are available from our Divya products and are really good for people of all ages. If you want details, I can, maybe if there is time for a question and answers, we could take it. What were the benefits? The quality of sleep improved. Many of them were depressed. One of them, for example, was a headmistress, and she said, "I'm so depressed. My children have abandoned me and put me in this home. I just signed away my land to my sons, and now they've left me here." And she was like not willing to come for any of the classes, not willing to participate. At the end, we found her very active and ready to participate. Gait and balance. As people grow older, their knees get weaker. So can we do something to reduce that? Can we give people the independence so that they don't need walkers and sticks and so on? Memory. This is something everyone would want to have, their memory intact right up to the time they are as old as they can possibly be. And good lung functions. Yoga can do a lot to prevent what is a natural part of aging, that is a reduction in our lung capacity. Many of these are published. All of these are published. So, yoga can promote positive health in children, in busy young adults, in older people. These are just glimpses of our research. We'll now look at prevention, disease prevention. This is one of the areas I'm very eager about, particularly obesity. What makes us feel like eating? Feeling, we all know this, feeling hungry and wanting to eat are not necessarily the same. When you're sitting with something which is particularly tempting, you may not realize that you're full. You may say, "I'm going to eat a little more because it's something that's nice to eat." So what we need to do is keep a balance between the energy that we consume and the energy spent. Stress is one of the things which can disturb this. We all know about comfort eating. So if a person is stressed, then they may eat a little more. Some people, when they're stressed, eat less. But that's just another thing. I'd now like to bring your attention, because it's going to be relevant to the two studies I present, to a chemical which is naturally produced in our body called leptin. Leptin is produced by the fat cells and suppresses the appetite. Okay? So we'll go very quickly. This is our health center in Haridwar. This is the fat that one has to be careful of on the left side. In South Asians, you often have people who are otherwise trim, but the weight collects around their waist. And that is really, really dangerous. It's associated with cancers, prostate cancer, breast cancer, with coronary artery disease, type 2 diabetes mellitus, hypertension, and so on. We found that yoga can help in reducing it. We did a single group trial, found benefits. And particularly, I want you to remember leptin for the next slide. You can see here we compared yoga and medium-paced walking and found that yoga increases leptin, that is the body's own natural appetite suppressant. So the natural appetite suppressant seems to be increased with yoga. It was a convincing study. We want to run more trials. In summary, yoga practice probably helps us to make healthy food choices. Management of disease, I'm not going to go into this in detail. What makes a particular person get a disease? It's a combination of the environment and the genes. These are some of the conditions which have benefited through yoga. These are the references. And last, I'd like to end by saying, I have presented yoga for wellness, but we have to keep in mind that yoga is something much more than that. Yoga was intended to help us to grow and evolve as better human beings, consciously evolve as better human beings, a spiritual evolution. Thank you very much.
Hello. Thank you, Dr. Tallis. I'm going to open the floor for maybe 4 or 5 questions, and I'm going to request that keep questions very direct to the topic she presented. Yoga, pranayama is a very vast subject. Keep it to 10 seconds. I'll give you an example. So, Dr. Tallis, you talked about 18 minutes of pranayama. If I get tired in 5 or 6, how do I get to 18?
Actually, the 18 minutes are broken up as 5 minutes of practice, 1 minute of rest, 5 minutes of practice, 1 minute of rest, 5 minutes of practice, 1 minute of rest. So, 3 epochs of practice, 1 minute of rest in between.
Dr. Tallis, nice to meet you again. My question is that coming to America around 30 years ago, one of the things I find that in India it was all Guru Pratha. Each ashram you go to, like a typical example, I'm a teacher for Art of Living, I'm a teacher for Patanjali. And the teacher of Baba Ramdev made a comment that Sri Sri Ravi Shankar is making too faster a breathing, and he corrected that. But I would like to see now we use this technology to bring the uniformity among all the ashrams and all the schools. Do you have a program to do that at this point?
Sure. In fact, the summit which I just came from in New York, the whole purpose is to make all our suggestions not based on any guru or any particular tradition, but based on science. And yes, we do have a package. So 10 seconds, that's all I'll say.
Why should it make any difference whether we breathe through left or right? Because we have got one larynx, it's going to go to two lungs. So process is same.
Right. At the back of the nose, right at the back here, where at the root of the nose, there are nerve endings. And when a scientist in Italy injected a dye there, the nerve endings took up the dye. And you were able to trace where those nerves originated from. From the left side of the left nostril originated, the nerve endings originated from nerves which are in a part of the hypothalamus which control the parasympathetic nervous system. The right side nostril, the nerve endings actually ended in a part of the hypothalamus which controls the sympathetic nervous system. So there's the innovation. Whether we insufflate or fill the nasal cavity with air or water or anything else, as long as we make contact with those nerve endings, we're going to send a message to two different parts of the hypothalamus in the brain, which activates either the sympathetic, which is the overdrive system, that is the fight or flight, or the parasympathetic from the left side, that is the rest and digest. Is that okay?
Thank you. Dr. Tallis, you can keep your answers as long as you want. Okay. I would like questions to be 10 seconds, so they are very direct. Thank you.
Okay. Ma'am, you also gave a list of diseases that could be helped by yoga. So how about type 1 diabetes in children?
Right. Well, this is more based on clinical experience. In type 1 diabetes, the problem is that the blood sugar levels are very brittle. That is, they keep swinging much more widely than in type 2 diabetes mellitus. So these wide swings or the brittle nature of the control is reduced. And if the swing is this wide, metaphorically speaking, it becomes narrower with yoga practice.
Thank you, Dr. Tallis, for a wonderful presentation. I've been practicing yoga pranayama for many years. But recently I've understood something which I want to clarify. Pranayama, the exercise we do, you know, Anulom Vilom, Bhastrika, Kapalbhati. I was told that these are breathing exercises. Pranayama by Patanjali, Rishi Patanjali, was defined as where you can actually stop and control the breath. Where do you draw the distinction?
Okay. How? Right. Literally, as you rightly have said, pranayama is a pause in the breathing. Well, with Kapalabhati, for example, if one breathes, say, at 60 breaths per minute, if you just take normal physiology, we're blowing out carbon dioxide. So at the end of Kapalabhati, there'll be a natural period of pause. In the same way, Bhastrika, we increase the depth of breathing. So at the end of Bhastrika, naturally, breath pauses. So the pause, we can either have breath holding, which we call Kumbhak, or it can happen naturally, as in Kapalbhati, where we blow out the oxygen. So for a short few seconds, there is a pause.
Thank you for a very well-informed, medically balanced explanation of pranayama. I wanted to ask you, you had talked about 18 minutes of pranayama per day, but could you explain if there is an increased benefit with breath-holding technique?
Yeah. Breath-holding techniques, well, I have done research on this and I've got publications. There are very profound benefits depending on whether the breath holding is long or short. Like you can have 1:4, 1 inhale, 4 hold, 2 exhale, 2 hold. That's long. Or you can have 2 inhale, 1 hold, 2 exhale, 1 hold. That's short. Now the two have opposite differences on the metabolism. I'm not going to go into it for one reason. Breath holding is a practice which is very powerful and should only be done one-on-one with a very trained yoga teacher, because it has to be combined with certain locks or what are called bandhas, like the chin lock, the abdominal lock, and the perineal lock. Jalandhar bandha, Udyan bandha, Mula bandha. So if you don't combine it with this, then a lot of energy can get unleashed, if I'm using slightly fringe science language, and people do have serious problems. But it's very profound, useful practice if you do with a trained teacher.
I'm asking this question regarding my health condition. I got brain hemorrhage just a few months back. And after repeated CT scan and MRI, I find that now I'm not having any new bleeding, but the old bleeding is still there. So, how much and what pranayama I should do to clean that up?
I would suggest that you do absolutely avoid anything which could increase pressure. So, for the time being, do not try Kapalbhati, Bhastrika. You can do things like Bhramari, Om chanting. This would be very good for you.